The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org. My name is Kurt Frankum, and I am a nice guy. No, seriously, I'm a nice guy. If you meet me in person or anywhere in life, you're going to walk away and think, that Kurt Frankum guy is a nice guy. But is that a good thing or is it a bad thing? Recently, I came across a book called No More Mr. Nice Guy, and written by a non-member, Dr. Robert Glover. And as I read it, I really appreciated his perspective and some of his research on this idea of the nice guy syndrome. And as I read it, I thought, okay, I have got to get Dr. Glover on the podcast because many leaders in the church, this nice guy part of them becomes magnified when they are put in leadership roles. And it's not a good magnification, okay? And it's actually causing more stress to them, to their families, to life, and sometimes completely knocking them off their rocker and sending them down paths that they really never intended to go. Also, it helped me gain a new perspective on how I'm raising my children, on how I was raised, on how, you know, and it wasn't a bad way. I know, mother, you're listening. You did a wonderful job teaching me. But nonetheless, there's these things in our culture that we never anticipated would be a bad way of doing things, but sometimes have unintended consequences. And so this podcast isn't necessarily full of answers, but it's full of new perspective and full of new conversations that we can have. And I think you'll love it. So his book is called No More Mr. Nice Guy, Dr. Glover. He actually now lives down in Mexico, but has had experience through his therapy practice with many Mormons. So here is my interview with Dr. Robert Glover, author of No More Mr. Nice Guy. Today, we have the opportunity to sit down with Dr. Robert Glover. How are you, Robert?
I'm great, Kurt. How you doing?
Good. Now, I'm excited to chat with you today. I came across your work sort of in a random way. I was listening to a podcast I don't typically listen to, and you were a guest on that. And listening to your research and the book you've written, it intrigued me so much that I went out and bought your book and read it. And I thought, you know, there's a lot we can talk about in your research as it relates to leadership in the LDS Church. So just by introduction, what do individuals need to know about you before we jump into the details of this discussion?
Well, just about me, I'll state first off, I'm a recovering nice guy. I'm one of those guys that grew up believing I had to be good, do everything right in order to be loved and liked and get my needs met. And I had to hide certain things about myself that I thought other people might disapprove of. I grew up in a very strong religious background, so that was a strong part of the influence. And probably about 25 years ago, this paradigm wasn't working well. And I was married, and my wife said, I'm tired of your passive aggressiveness. I'd rather be married to a jerk. At least I know a jerk's going to treat me bad. You know, you treat me well. You know, everybody thinks you're great until all of a sudden, when I'm not expecting it, you do something that really hurts me badly. So you need to go get some therapy. And I thought, well, okay. So I actually joined a men's group and started working with a therapist, trying to find out why me being a nice guy didn't make my wife appreciate me more, didn't make her treat me better, didn't make her happier, didn't make her want to have more sex with me. You know, it seemed like no matter what I did, it was never good enough. She was never happy. And so luckily I fell in with some good therapists and some good help and quickly started learning some things that really helped me start focusing on me. And really realize why this paradigm of trying to please other people or avoid conflict or do it right or hide my faults or give to get, why that wasn't working well and why it was actually fundamentally dishonest and not particularly loving. So that's how I got started with it. I was a marriage and family therapist at that time. And then I started working with with other men who identified as nice guys. And I just started writing chapters to give to them. And they kept saying, you should write a book. You should go on Oprah. And I kept writing, and it did turn into a book. It was published about 15 or so years ago. And now I pretty much work exclusively with men. I live in Mexico now. I work online. I do workshops and seminars. I have an online university. So that's just a little snapshot about me.
Awesome. Great. And I have to ask you, we don't have too many non-Mormons on the podcast, but when we do, I just have to ask them, any unique connection to Mormonism or awkward interaction you've had with our missionaries or anything like that?
No, never had an awkward interaction. But yeah, I'm originally from the Seattle area. So I grew up with had a lot of Mormon friends. My first girlfriend in sixth grade was Mormon and went to BYU. And that was long after she was my girlfriend. Yeah, sure. And then as a therapist working in the Seattle area, a lot of guys came and joined my groups that identified as Mormon. And one of the things I would tell these guys when they started working with me, I would say, often my experience was that Mormons struggled in therapy, because therapy is about being open and honest and transparent. And there are certain things in Mormon culture that actually, at least the culture, works to discourage that. And a lot of the Mormon men would kind of shake their head. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. And I said, so therapy can be a challenge for you to actually work at revealing yourself, your cracks, your flaws, your insecurities, your shame, your mistakes, your problem areas, where you're stuck. And my experience working with the Mormon men was always very positive, just because it just seems like, you know, they wanted to be good men. So what we had to do was help them get rid of that paradigm that being a nice guy wasn't the same thing as being a good man.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful and a strong message from your book. And again, the title of your book is No More Mr. Nice Guy. And you talk about this nice guy syndrome. And obviously, I get the impression this is your term. It's not necessarily a clinical term, right?
It's not a clinical term. And actually, I did not use the word I'm about to use in the book, mainly because I didn't want, you know, people get an idea of a word in their head, and then they kind of then identifies what they're looking at. So nice guy syndrome is basically codependency. But I didn't use that term in the book because I wanted to define nice guys, because most of the writing on codependency was either directed at women in codependent relationships or relationships people had with addicts. And I wanted to show how men get uniquely trained and internalize a belief system, like I said, that they're not okay just as they are, and they have to become something else to be loved and liked, and they have to hide things about themselves. So even though nice guy syndrome, you won't find it in the DSM-5, psychological disorders, mm-hmm. it fundamentally is a codependent self. I'm not okay just as I am, and I get my definition of self from outside of me, from externalized validation.
Yeah, and that's one question I was going to ask you later on is, you know, as I was reading this, I thought, you know, a lot of this sounds like codependency, but maybe there's a difference there. So I'm glad you clarified that. And this is so true in, you know, you mentioned the culture, and I'd love, you know, feel free to draw upon your experience working with Mormons in your therapy practice as we go through this. But there is this, especially as a leader, you sort of define yourself by how many homes you're visiting, how much you're doing for other people, how much service you're giving and that sort of thing. And so as we talk here, I do so on maybe with two goals. One, I know that there's many leaders listening, maybe bishops, elders, quorum presidents, who may interact with individuals who they can see, oh, this guy he's trying to be a nice guy, and that may be a problem here. But also, the thing, probably the biggest reason I want to talk with you is this idea that the leaders face, that when they're called to leadership, you know, in a lay ministry, they're suddenly put on this pedestal, and so they want to overcompensate by being a really nice guy. And nobody wants to be the mean bishop. Nobody wants to be the leader that people don't like. And so we really try and be Mr. Smiley in the back. We're shaking everybody's hand. We'll meet with anybody and listen to their problems and give encouragement. But sometimes this can be a trap, right?
Yeah, it can. And as I mentioned before you and I started, I was a minister for 8 years in a much earlier part of my life. And yeah, I fell into that same trap. You know, as you're talking about standing in the back, smiling, saying yes to everybody. We can talk some more about that. I learned some valuable lessons. But how about, let me share three core characteristics of a nice guy to kind of segue with what you're talking about, both in terms of, as leaders listening to this, of what they might recognize in men that they're working with, but also in their own selves. And it's these three covert contracts that really define the nice guy paradigm. And they're the things that get in the way for a nice guy. They're the things that keep him from being fundamentally honest, from getting his needs met, from actually having a full bucket that he can actually give to others, you know, instead of giving from that empty bucket. So those three covert contracts, number one is, and they're all if-then paradigms, and they're all fundamentally manipulative too. But number one, if I'm a good guy, then I will be liked and loved. And you mentioned that people in the leadership roles in the church, you know, okay, if I'm this great bishop, if I just, you know, like you say, smile and say yes to everybody, then I'll be liked and loved. And actually that is, we all want to be liked and loved, of course, but if our sense of lovableness, our lovability comes from an external source, in a sense, if you think about it, that's actually non-Christian, because, you know, the other people approving of us is not the source of our value. It's our inherent connection to God. So that is not only not workable if I'm giving to get, I'm going to do everything, I'll be a good guy, and then you'll like and love me. It's also not consistent with the doctrine of most faiths. Yeah. Covert contract number two, if I meet other people's needs without them having to ask, then they will meet my needs without me having to ask. And again, this is giving to get. It has strings attached, but it creates all kinds of problems, because number one, other people usually don't know there was a covert contract here, this hidden agreement that this person, this nice guy, is doing things for me. Now I owe them something, and I'm supposed to read their mind and know what they want as well. And in addition to the other people not knowing of the covert contract, I found in general, nice guys are terrible receivers. We're not very good at asking for what we want. And when people do try to give to us, it makes us really uncomfortable. Often we feel guilty, like, oh no, I can't let this person give to me. Then I don't know if we have a sense of emotional debt, or we think that we're bad, or we think somebody will have a negative reaction to us. So we nice guys tend to make it really difficult for other people to give to us, even though we're giving to them, hoping they will give in return, which, we can talk more about this, leads to a lot of problems, a lot of resentments, a lot of passive aggressive behavior, and a lot of what I call victim pukes, where we kind of just blow up because we've let so much build up inside. So we can come back to that.
Awesome.
The third covert contract of the nice guy syndrome is that if I do everything right, then I will have a smooth, problem-free life. And this covert contract doesn't work for a number of reasons. Number one, we can't do everything right. That's just an impossibility. We're human. We're flawed. We're imperfect. If we could do everything right, we wouldn't need any redemption of any sort from God. We wouldn't need the work of Jesus in our life. So the other problem is, life is not smooth and problem-free. It was never meant to be smooth and problem-free. Life is chaotic by nature. It's constantly changing. And this can lead to a lot of frustrations for nice guys when we think, I've done it right, I've followed the rules, I've been the good guy, you know, I haven't done this, I haven't done that, but yet, you know, again, like, my wife isn't responding well or treating me well or appreciating me, my kids are rebelling, you know, my business is going under, I'm sick, whatever it may be, you know, we think, I've kept my side of the contract, you know, where's God, where's, you know, the universe, where's my wife, where's my kids, they're all supposed to appreciate me back, and my world's supposed to go smoothly. So maybe a few people listening can recognize those three tendencies that they have, that trying to be a good guy, to be loved and liked, giving to other people, hoping other people will give back, and trying to do everything right so that we'll have a smooth, problem-free life. And those are the things that are really kind of the devil in the details that get in the way for most nice guys actually getting what they really want in life and being what I call an integrated man. An authentic, honest, integrated person.
I love that. That's that's powerful. And is it just a matter of, I mean, would you recommend any other steps if an individual sort of trying to recognize this in themselves? I mean, I guess for my experience, just reading them, I really resonated with a lot of the points, thinking, oh my goodness, I think I've fallen into this nice guy syndrome.
Well, as you've read the book, and in my book, as you recall, I give a lot of examples. And that's where a lot of nice guys can relate. And I often tell that my book is actually autobiographical. I just use other people's lives to illustrate everything I've struggled with as a nice guy. at the end, you know, I think we'll probably mention my website. On my website, I've got a quiz that guys can take to see how they score on, and you know, how nice of a guy they are. But one of the things, if the men listening, and I don't know this, but I'm assuming that the men in leadership position in LDS are all married. Is that accurate?
Definitely the bishops are. There's somewhat of a requirement to, well, yeah, scriptural to be married. But I mean, there can be many leaders that aren't necessarily married, or they're younger, so they just haven't, they're not in that stage of life yet. So,
well, the reason I ask is that people, the guys listening, if they suspect, well, maybe that's me, go talk. If they're married, go ask their wife. Ask their wife, do you notice me using these covert contracts? Do I try to, you know, be a good guy so people will like me and love me? Do I give with strings attached, hoping that people will give back? And do you think I'm trying to do everything right to have a smooth, problem-free life? Go ask somebody who knows you really well. Gotcha. And if they're kind of start nodding their head, you know, vigorously while you're asking the questions. But I found that most men who can click off, you know, check off all those boxes of the nice guy syndrome, usually see themselves pretty quickly. And especially they can relate to the frustrations of after they've tried to do all these things right, things still aren't going like they expect. As I said, their relationships maybe aren't working like they expected. Maybe if they're a single guy, you know, they're trying to treat women with respect and be the good guy and not be the jerk they've heard women complain about. And but yet at the same time, the women don't seem to be interested. Maybe even tell them, well, you'll make some lucky woman a great husband someday. And the guy's thinking, well, how come you're not interested in me? You know, you're the one I'm trying to, you know, make an impression on. You're the one I would like to think that, you know, you'd be a lucky woman to have me. And then maybe just in work and career, I actually teach an online class called Nice Guys Don't Finish Last. They rot in middle management. And a lot of times the nice guy behaviors show up at work, our codependency, our giving to get. Instead of focusing on things we need to get done, we're helping out other people. And it starts showing up in that we don't live up to our full potential. Or, you know, if we're self-employed, our businesses don't seem to move ahead like we think they should. And a lot of it's because of those nice guy tendencies.
Yeah. And in the book, you make a reference or connection to the as far as where this nice guy syndrome comes from. Many times it comes from a rough childhood. And that sort of made me pause because I thought, well, I see myself a lot of these covert contracts in my own personality, but I didn't, you know, my childhood was pretty good. My parents loved me, but, you know, I didn't experience any trauma or abuse. And so I thought, I wonder, is that required or is that just overly typical in these situations?
Well, and actually, it isn't so much that in general, nice guys come from a rough background. In fact, when I started working with nice guys, when I started realizing there were more people than just me that had this paradigm of the nice guy syndrome, I assumed maybe they were all kind of like me. And probably, you know, my childhood wasn't, you know, all that terrible. My father was moody and could be critical and angry. My mother was a codependent and tried to make everything good and please everybody. Like I said, I grew up in a fundamental Christian church and that really didn't include much in terms of the grace of God. It was more about the anger and wrath of God. And so those things influenced me. And I also became a teenager during the late 60s, early 70s, when feminism was really strong. And a lot of that was an angry feminism that, you know, men were the cause of all the problems in the world. And so I didn't want to be like that bad man. And my mother had already trained me to not be like my father. So it wasn't like my childhood was terrible. My parents didn't divorce. They were married till my dad died about 9 years ago. You know, they took me to church. We were kind of lower middle class family. You know, nothing terrible, no out and out abuse. But the nice guy syndrome often develops in young boys, often at a very, 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 very young age, like a few months old, a few years old, when our brain is not fully developed, the reasoning part of our brain in men doesn't fully develop to around 25. Now, our emotional part of our brain is fully wired and online when we're born, that the part that controls survival, the fight, flight, freeze. So when we have any kind of experience as a child that doesn't feel good, that feels painful or feels frightening or triggers a sense of abandonment. And I remember learning in Child Development 101, every child's greatest fear is abandonment because we're so helpless. So it doesn't take growing up necessarily in a bad situation to trigger this sense of, uh-oh, I'm scared or I'm in pain and this doesn't feel good. And this is all being processed by the emotional brain, not an adult reasoning brain. And all of us, all human beings, tend to develop a couple of defense mechanisms to help us manage our painful experiences in childhood. And again, that may have nothing to do with abuse. It may just mean being hungry, or maybe being colicky or being sick, or your parents not being real available because they're working or they're poor, or you have a sick brother that needs their attention, or a baby is born, you know, and all of a sudden you don't get that attention you used to get. It could be a lot of different things. But all children develop two very unconscious survival mechanisms. One of them is to try to manage the discomfort they're feeling in the moment, that emotional, physical discomfort. Maybe a child sucks his thumb. Maybe they eat. Maybe they quit crying. Maybe they do a number of things. Another defense mechanism that children tend to develop is a defense mechanism that has the goal of preventing these painful events from happening again in the future. So all children do this. Now, these become our roadmaps, our paradigms. And, you know, the majority of adults walking this planet are using roadmaps for dealing with the discomfort of life that they learned or that they internalized, usually inaccurately, at 3 months old, 3 years old. But because they're the only roadmap we've ever had, we think they're 100% accurate. But an illustration that I often use is kind of like, you know, having a roadmap of Seattle and trying to get around Los Angeles using the roadmap of Seattle and believing it should work. And when it doesn't work, we don't have any other alternative other than just try harder using that roadmap. Or maybe we go searching and often we end up finding something extreme all the way from addictions to cults or other things to try to give us answers. But if we can step back and we don't even have to like go dig up everything from our past or our childhood, but we can ask ourselves, what do I tend to do to ease my pain, my discomfort, my anxiety in the moment? And what do I try to do to prevent these things from happening to me in life in general? That's where you'll find the real foundations of whatever roadmap or life paradigm that you're using. And nice guy syndrome is just one of many types of roadmaps or paradigms that children develop.
Yeah. And what I'm learning, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but you know, you look at some individuals who've had just a traumatic childhood and maybe they experience some level of post-traumatic, you know, syndrome or some of these really intense mental health concerns. But sometimes the nice guy syndrome can come out of a very normal childhood, but that, how do I articulate this? But with all the good intentions, for example, if religion doesn't cause nice guys, but maybe the culture, the unintended culture of religion sometimes does, right? This message of be good or you'll burn in hell, you know, that's not necessarily what the pastor was saying on Sunday, but that's how the 8-year-old heard it, right?
Yeah, and I use that word quite a bit too, the culture of a particular religion or faith or denomination. And they all have different cultures and core messages. But one thing I know is that it's not unusual for children raised in a religious environment to get the message one way or another, either from church, Sunday school, their parents, that they have to look good, you know, don't look like a bad person. And this can be especially true in families and especially, you know, as you're talking to leaders. Unfortunately, a lot of times leaders in the church put a lot of pressure, you know, maybe inadvertently on their kids to look good, to, you know, to toe the line and not mess up. Because how would it look if you have a bishop who's, you know, who has a child that, you know, drops out of high school or, you know, starts experimenting with drugs or alcohol, you know, all of a sudden, well, that doesn't look good. So there's that pressure. And one roadmap that some children develop to deal with those kind of pressures is they become oppositionally defiant. And that is, okay, if I follow all your rules, that means you always win, I always lose, there is no me, and that is painful for there to be no me, so I have to do the opposite of what's important to you. And I'm sure you see that in leaders in the church as well, where they may have one child that just goes the other extreme. And they're not necessarily rejecting, you know, the tenets of the faith. Probably what they're rejecting is this sense that they have to always look good and do everything right to be approved of. And maybe they do it sometimes just to get attention, just to get any kind of attention. Because, you know, If you're a man in a leadership role, you can be so busy that unfortunately, one of the things that gets sacrificed is your family and what your kids need.
Yeah. And really any organization where it's a, whether it's a church or a family that's setting some standards, right? And saying, you know, us, I remember that the infamous phrase, and I think other families use it as well, that in my home, it was often said that Frankhams don't do that or Frankhams act a different way, right? And I appreciated that from my parents because it challenged me to be better and to stand, make my, or help my name stand for something, right? And I encourage that. But at the same time, that can sort of not work against them because, oh, there's a standard, so you must always be a good boy. And if you're not a good boy, others may see that and you won't be worthy or you won't, you know, you just won't live up to the standards we have, and we can't have that, right? And so that's sort of where
we can't have that. And what you just described, the technical term for that is called emotional fusion. And I define fusion and as you belong to us, therefore you should. So you're one of us. You have our last name, therefore you should. And fill in the blank. And unfortunately, that doesn't help children negotiate the struggles of development, especially during their teenage years. When they're beginning, they're trying to figure out, who am I? What makes me happy? How do I view the world? What do I think's right? How do I want to live in this world? And they begin to, you know, their hormones begin to surge and they begin to want the attention of the opposite sex. They begin to differentiate, which is healthy, from their parents and the rules of their parents. And they begin to question or challenge. And if the family message is, you know, you belong to us, you're one of us, you're this, you're, you know, we don't accept that. You can't do that in this family. Often the child only has two choices, basically, either to just completely give in, give up self and just give in and follow the rules. But there's actually no sense of self or even true faith in that because they're just following rules. So they haven't accepted a belief system because it feels right to their core. They're just following rules. The other option is they got to push all of the rules away, not just a few, not just, you know, their parents trying to impose. They got to push everything away and they just go to the other extreme. And often, unfortunately, that is kind of like cutting off your nose to spite your face. It's often that oppositional defiant, that pushback is often very self-destructive. And so you often see people in this kind of pushback turning to drugs, to alcohol, to addiction, to casual, you know, non-committed type sex, to doing things that are actually really hurtful over the long term.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm just thinking of maybe youth leaders in the church. I mean, what's a youth leader to do? I mean, if they, every time they bring up like, you know, no premarital sex or no drug or alcohol, you know, how do they avoid falling into this factory of Mr. Nice Guys?
I'm smiling at that question because I got fired from my first job in the church. I was a youth minister and my first job ever. I was just out of graduate school and I got a job up in the Ozarks of Arkansas and a pretty conservative area. And there they had what they called dry counties, i.e. you could not buy alcohol in certain counties. So everybody just drove across the county line to where there were several bars right across the county line to go drink or buy alcohol. And the church I grew up in, like I said, was fairly fundamental. And at least in this part of the country where I was working, was pretty conservative around alcohol. And I know Mormonism is conservative around alcohol as well in terms of substances that are harmful to the body. But what I saw was, and this was my first job as a youth minister, that I saw the teenagers grew up with just the messages, don't drink, it's a sin. You know, that's kind of the message the parents gave. But yet they'd go away to college and or leave home and just go nuts. They'd go crazy. They would just, you know, like, oh, I'm free now. I can do whatever I want. And, you know, maybe go to college and just, you know, that's all they did was drink. And I thought, okay, just telling them don't drink is a sin didn't seem to be helping them create a value system that worked for them and that was consistent with their faith. And so I remember in one, you know, class session I had with the teenagers, you know, I was talking to them about how do we create personal values. And, you know, I use that as an example of, you know, your parents may give you their personal values and say, do this because, you know, the Bible says it, therefore it's a sin, don't do it. Kind of like in the church I grew up in, there was a phrase that said, Jesus said it, I believe it, that settles it. And it's kind of like, okay, that's all the discussion we're going to have. Your interpretation of what Jesus said is the one that I have to live by because, you know. So, and one or two of parents in this church I was working in didn't like the fact that I didn't just tell their kids, drinking is a sin, don't do it, that I was actually talking about creating value systems that they could integrate and make their own and guide them when they have tough choices without their parents around telling them, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And a couple of them went to the church I was in, to the elders, and complained about that. And I ended up getting fired from my first job ever. And so I relate to what you're talking about. And I don't know that there's an easy answer to it, but we do have to help our young people and children integrate a belief system that makes sense to them. Just telling them, believe this because, you know, that's what our church believes, or, you know, do this because that's what, you know, we as your parents say you should do, doesn't necessarily serve them well as they move into adulthood. And not giving them room to even like maybe push back or struggle with the tenets of faith doesn't do them any good either, because what is a faith that hasn't been tested or challenged? And so, but that's scary for parents when their kids start testing or challenging, you know, the faith that they hold on to, and they have a fear that their children are going to spin out of control and become self-destructive. So I don't have an easy answer on this one, other than we have to have loving, intelligent discussions, not just because I said so. That's not a really good answer.
Yeah. And not that an answer is necessary, but I think what is more helpful than a really clear answer is just taking the time as a youth leader or as a church leader to realize that this dynamic exists. Because a lot of the time we don't even address it, right? We don't even act like that. If we just set clear standards, and if they don't, if they don't follow, that means they've been deceived, or they're just, you know, for other reasons that don't help either, you know? So I think just being aware and having this discussion as youth leaders or as, ward leaders, whatever it is, would be well worth your time. So let me shift a little bit. I didn't plan to spend so much time on that side of the topic, but it's very, very much worth it. So let's say as a bishop, an individual comes in and life's been tough, and, you know, I'm trying to do so much for my wife and she doesn't even care. And, you know, these nice guy covert contracts are just like pouring out of him, right? And if a leader sees that, a bishop sees that, now obviously bishops aren't trained therapists, and so, but they have resources to refer individuals who need therapy there. So if they see this nice guy, these nice guys trait, does that typically mean they do need to see a professional therapist and work some of these out?
It is helpful. Here's one thing as you've read the book, and one thing that I repeat throughout the book is don't try to do this alone. One thing about nice guys, because we believe we have to hide our faults, our flaws, our mistakes, our insecurities, our imperfections, we think I can figure this out. I can do this alone. And I bet you've seen this a lot.
Absolutely.
Within men, within the church. They just keep everything inside and they try to figure it all out on their own. And whether this is dealing with maybe an addiction or pornography or frustrations in their marriage, I'll figure it out alone. And like I said, the nice guys did not internalize this paradigm in social isolation. So we're not going to fix it by isolating ourselves. So I'm a big advocate, and I talk about this a lot in the book, go find safe people. Go find somebody that you can open up and talk about and reveal what you're struggling with, where you feel flawed or imperfect, or where your toxic shame is, that belief that I'm not good enough. And go find safe people that can give you more accurate information that it's okay to be a flawed, imperfect human being. We don't have to hide that. And it's actually our imperfections that allow us to connect with each other. I mean, we can't connect with Teflon people, with people that look so good, so smooth. We look at them and go, I don't even know how to relate to them because that's not how I feel inside.
Yeah.
So we need to go find a safe place. And one of the things, especially with men, I did a lot of my work working on my own nice guy issues within groups of men that were, you know, directed around helping men open up, talk about themselves, you know, connect with each other, get accurate feedback that, you know, I'm okay just because I struggle with this addiction, or I keep falling back into pornography use, or, you know, sometimes I blow up at my kids, or, you know, I get frustrated that my wife doesn't want to have sex as much as I want. Number one, you find out you're not alone. And number two, you find out you're not a bad person just because everything isn't perfect in your life. And then you can also start finding a paradigm that's a more accurate roadmap to use and start learning tools that are more helpful to get what you want in life. And for example, learning to accept life isn't smooth and problem-free. Life is chaotic and challenging, but that's what helps us grow as individuals, is learning to deal with challenge in life and deal with change and deal with difficult situations. So yes, I'd really recommend that if, you know, people come into connection with somebody they think might be a nice guy, maybe recommend a book. Because a lot of people that come to me say, hey, so-and-so recommended this book to me, you know, an ex-girlfriend or my wife gave it to me, or, you know, a bishop gave it to me, or a friend in 12-step program gave it to me. And I found that I've never had anybody say, I was really pissed off that they gave me this book. Usually they say, maybe they say I left it on a shelf for 3 years before I picked it up. But then when I was going through a difficult time, I picked it up and read it. But why didn't I read it 3 years ago? So that's a good place to start, is even just recommending the book. And then, of course, the book suggests go find safe people to talk to and start opening up and revealing yourself and getting more accurate feedback about your worth and your value and who you are. And you don't have to hide everything or keep everything a secret.
Yeah. And that's definitely my experience that, you know, as I was reading the book and I sort of self-identified as, wow, I think a lot of areas I'm a nice guy. I didn't run off to therapy or anything, but just reading the books and being aware of it, I had, my wife and I had some incredible discussions about, oh, here, here, and here, I can see that I'm doing that wrong. Because sometimes, you know, she's had a bad day, she's upset. And I'm like, okay, listen, I'll wash the kids tonight. I'll do the dishes. I'm going to scrub the toilets. How do you feel now? Do you feel good now? You know, and so
you're happy now, right? Right.
Right. Exactly. Where now I'm just sort of like, oh, she's having a bad day. Well, I'm going to get my work done, and tomorrow she'll probably come out of it. And I talked to her about it, and she felt no, like she wasn't thinking, why isn't he scrubbing the toilets, or why isn't he when I feel bad? She was just like, yeah, you know, just ran into some frustrations, but I'm good now. Right. And so just being aware of it and talking about it, you know, even with a spouse or a loved one, that was enough for me. Right.
Yeah, I'd recommend for guys that are married or are in a relationship, you know, get a copy of the book and get a yellow highlighter and a pink highlighter, and you read it and highlight the things you can relate to. And then, you know, maybe a chapter at a time, then let your wife or girlfriend read it with her highlighter, and she can underline the things she can relate to, not only in you, but maybe in herself as well. Because I suspect that maybe a lot of Mormon women are nice girls as well.
Yeah, right.
They do it right, trying to look good, trying to be the good support system for their husband, trying to be the good mom to their kids. And, you know, there's probably just as many nice girls as there are nice guys in the church. So read it together and highlight it and talk about it. And just like you said, just the fact that you could talk about it and understand each other better, it's huge in itself.
Yeah. And this is sort of a little off topic, but I have it noted here that, and maybe this falls in one of the three covert contracts, but one thing I resonated with is nice guys are chameleons, right? They're trying to be whatever that person in front of me needs, I'm going to be that guy, right? And I adjust and just conform to that situation. Is that, how would you articulate?
That's probably includes all three covert contracts in one. You know, I'll look like the good guy. I'll become what this person wants. I'll hide this part. Yeah. A lot of guys will tell me, yeah, when I'm at work, I'm this way. When I'm with my guy friends, I'm this way. When I'm with my church friends, I'm like this. When I'm with my non-church friends, I'm like this. When I'm with my wife, I'm like this. So it's that chameleon thing. And there's no sense of self. Who am I? In all contexts. And that's why I actually began the book talking about why nice guys are fundamentally not nice. And one of the core reasons that nice guys are not nice is that there's no fundamental sense of self. There's no true self. There's no you that shows up in all contexts. No, there's no what you see, what you get, authentic person. And so therefore, every time we're not us in any context, we're actually lying. You know, if this is who I really am, what I really think, what I really feel, how I really go about my life when nobody's looking, and I change that, I become the chameleon for others, that's a lie. That's fundamentally dishonest. And dishonesty is one of the core dynamics of nice guy syndrome. So here's the paradox, as we're trying to look like I'm a good guy, right? Whatever that context is, you know, the trying to look like a good guy is actually being dishonest. And what I found personally is that if I'm dishonest about the core of who I am, I find myself being dishonest about a lot of things without me really being conscious of how far from the truth, how far from integrity that I actually am in my life. It just starts feeling normal.
Yeah. And if we're not being the person we are, that's where the pressure starts to build up, right? Under the surface. Because one dynamic we have in our church is obviously we have these temples across the world. And in order to go into a temple, you need a temple recommend. And in order to get a temple recommend, you have to live a certain level of standards and variety of areas and commandments, right? And so it's one thing to have the temple recommend, but it's another thing to really, really know that you're living up there, because that can be a status symbol a little bit. That if you don't have a temple recommend, well, something's wrong with you. You're not fitting the mold here, right? And so we can answer the questions many times honestly, but if our life isn't really projecting some of those things, I mean, I think that's where the pressure builds, the thinking, okay, I go to the temple, but if somebody really knew who I was, right? And so it's important to process this.
Well, it is. And one of the things, as I mentioned at the beginning of our talk, is that one of the things nice guys often start doing at a very young age is hiding certain things about themselves, things that they might think will get disapproval from parents, church, culture, whatever that may be. And the two things that nice guys tend to hide the most, number one is their wants and needs, and number two is their sexuality. Because those are two things that we think will get a negative response from other people if we're fairly transparent about what our needs and wants are and who we are as a sexual being. And so a lot of nice guys push those things underground. They push their needs and wants underground, which makes them manipulative, like we've talked about with covert contracts. They actually rob people of the joy of giving to them because they think they're bad for having wants and needs. But a really big core area I found with nice guys is that underground sexuality. And our sexuality is part of who we are, is part of being human. But if we think we have to hide all of it or parts of it, we can't really hide it. It's a life force that cannot be pushed down. It's like putting a lid on a pressure cooker and turning the heat up when we try to hide it. So one thing I found that is a lot of nice guys have a lot of dark or hidden sexual behaviors. Mm-hmm. And I've often said that I would estimate that maybe 75% of nice guys have some issues around pornography. Either they're just flat out addicted to it. They can't quit looking at it. And this applies to religious people, maybe even more so to religious people. Or maybe they look at it in secret occasionally, but then have a big shame attack afterwards and then kind of push it away till they get that impulse to look again. And then they feel so defective and they can't really talk to anybody about it. They don't want their wife to know. So that secret of sexuality is one that can be such a big bugaboo, and it's one that can create such guilt, as like you say, if we're trying to get whatever that status is or that recognition in the church or peers or with family. But yeah, we got this thing hidden and we feel like a fraud. We feel like a hypocrite, and we have that constant fear of being found out. And man, that's a miserable way to live. And often, eventually, we do get found out. Something crashes and burns, and we probably have all known somebody that we thought, oh man, they're a leader. They're an icon in the church. They're the person that we thought had it all together until they didn't, until it all came crumbling down, because they were trying to hide and push so many things down. And again, if we have a culture that encourages that, who's going to be the one that breaks that cultural rule and just says, oh, by the way, I'm struggling with this. Anybody else, invite a discussion about it.
Yeah. Now, obviously you talk about, the nice guy is always trying to be good so that he is therefore loved and liked. And so that usually means, oh, I'm going to be at every service opportunity. I'm going to serve in any position they ask me to in the church and really give it my all. So I guess you're also not saying that you should avoid being a nice guy and therefore be a jerk, right?
No, and that's actually, people ask this question at the beginning of the interview, not towards the end. And I know that the title of the book has a certain paradox to it. It creates kind of an emotional dissonance, cognitive dissonance, because like maybe we've all said it at some point, no more Mr. Nice Guy, I'm not going to take this anymore. But at the same time, we go, well, why would somebody write a book teaching men to be not nice? There's enough not nice men out there. We don't need to teach more men to be not nice. But I think once people pick the book up, they quickly see that I'm not talking about going from one dysfunctional extreme to another. In fact, a lot of guys say, well, okay, I get that being a nice guy doesn't work, but I don't want to be a jerk. So where do I find the kind of the happy middle ground? And I go, it doesn't exist. I don't know where the tipping point is between two toxic extremes. Mm-hmm. And I talk in the book about becoming an integrated male. An integrated male is a person who's not driven by their anxiety, they're not driven by seeking approval. They can ask themselves, what do I want? What's important to me? They have a sense of self. They're not driven by the need to hide their toxic shame. And in the book, I talk about how to create tools to help you do those things in your life. So no, I'm not teaching men how to be jerks, and that's not the answer. But for example, one of the things, we nice guys, we have a hard time saying no. In the example that I give, back when I was a minister and in my early 20s, at least the church I was in, the minister, after he preaches a sermon, goes to the back and everybody walks out the back door, and you shake everybody out was the term. Shake everybody's hand. And one of the things that people on the way out would say, oh, can you order some more, Bible school material for me? And I'd always just say yes. That was my default answer to yes. Oh, can you go visit my uncle who's in the hospital this week? Yeah, sure. Can you do this? And I just would say yes to everything. Now, two things would happen. Number one, I would forget most of the requests because, I'm not writing them down and I don't have a photographic memory. And I was saying yes to stuff that maybe I didn't have time to do, didn't really want to do, wasn't the best use of my time. I hated doing whatever it might be. I'd just say yes to everything. And then I'd either forget or procrastinate or not follow through. And then then I'm explaining and defending and people are upset. So I learned a really simple solution to that is I'd say, please call the church office and leave a message. That way there's a reminder of it. And it would give me some time to think, do I want to do this? Is this something I need to delegate to somebody else? Is this the best use of my time? And those are legitimate questions to ask, and especially for people in a leadership role. Kind of leaving a church example, I worked with a client several years ago who worked at Microsoft. And he came to see me and he said, I never have any time. My wife and I, we have no time to do anything. She worked at Microsoft too. I take my laptop home. I never have any time for my wife, and we want to have kids someday. And I said, well, why do you never have time to get anything done? He said, and he showed me his schedule. He had 3, 4, 5 meetings every day. And I said, how do you get any work done if you're in meetings all day long? He said, well, I'm in PR. So whenever anybody calls and needs somebody from PR, I say, yes, I go to a meeting. And I said, well, what is your ambition at Microsoft? And he said, well, I want to be a general director or a vice president someday. And I said, well, do vice presidents say yes to every meeting request that comes along? And I said, well, no, they can't. They've got to decide where's the best use of my time? And I said, okay, make this your mantra. Vice presidents say no. And then we could even play bishops say no.
Yeah.
And so he started making that his mantra. Vice presidents say no. And within a year, he had started rising so quickly that he applied and got the job to be, at the time, Steve Ballmer, the CEO of Microsoft. He was personal traveling PR person. For 2 years, he traveled with Ballmer in his private jet all over the world. And he got there because he started developing a mentality of, I need to say no to things that are not the best use of my time. So even though that can be hard, we're afraid we might upset somebody, that, we may not be that, we may not be liked. There is value in judiciously saying no to some things, and it lets you say yes to what's most valuable, including your family, your wife, and your kids, so you don't get caught up because you've said yes to everybody else.
Right. Oh, man, that's such a fantastic point and so applicable to the dynamic of leadership in our church. I remember as bishop, I was in charge of all welfare that, I signed the checks if somebody needed help with rent or food or whatever it is. And I remember many times I'd get a phone call on a Tuesday night or whatever it is, during the week. And an individual would kind of be in chaos of, hey, I need a check tonight, or this is going to happen, or this consequence will happen. And I forced myself to say, well, actually, I only sign checks on Sundays. So you're going to have to figure something else before that. And a lot of new bishops, they want to be the person that's like, oh, well, whatever you need, I'm going to put on my Superman cape and come to the rescue, right? And sometimes it's difficult to say no, but that by, and this is a point you make, is that to help with the nice guy syndrome is that it's so important to focus on yourself or on your family, right? It's stop focusing on the church every day and focus on your family, right? And that was one way that I did that, is by telling that person, that's not how the structure works. And I love your example because it creates, you draw boundaries, right? And structure saying, this is how it works. So if you need help, I'm happy to help you, but first do this. And then it gives you time to really consider it, right?
Yeah. And you just really hit on two core things that I work a lot with nice guys. And one is around the boundaries, which, we could do a whole interview around that. Mm-hmm. And the other is that taking good care of self, which makes a lot of nice guys uncomfortable. It makes a lot of religious people uncomfortable. But the bottom line is, if we don't make our needs a priority, if we do not fill our own bucket, there's nothing left to pour out for other people. And that's a problem a lot of people have, especially a lot of parents, is that we're doing so much and giving so much that we end up getting sick or depressed or turning to addictive type behaviors because the bucket is so empty. And even if you look at the life of Christ, you know, he came to serve, but he did things to fill his own bucket. He took good care of himself as needed so that he could then give in a sacrificial way to other people.
Yeah, that was exactly the example I was headed towards. As many times we want to go to, you know, we want to be Christ-like or ask ourselves, what would Jesus do? And because we have the Bible that's full of stories where he did say yes, but we really don't see the majority of answers he said, which were no, right? There were many times I'm sure he said, no, I can't help you with that. Or this is, I'm of my father's business, right? That was maybe a way he said that I'm focusing on myself and my father's business, not necessarily on your needs.
Yeah. Or even telling his own apostles, sit here for a little while. I'm going off by myself.
Yeah.
You know, just even taking time to be alone. I mean, how many people listening to this in recent days or weeks have consciously taken time to just go be alone, just go be still, to be in nature, to contemplate, to pray, to read, to just be still and be alone and fill your bucket up? I'm trying to think of words for it. I'm self-employed. I'm a husband. I'm a parent. I'm a granddad. I own a home that needs stuff done. I mean, there's always something that needs done. And I just relish being able to just go away, go out in the backyard in the garden or living here in Puerto Vallarta and go. My wife and I, we've started a habit now. We drop the kids off at school at 7:30. We go sit on the beach for 30 minutes and we just sit and watch the birds and listen to the waves, just that quiet, still time. If I can just take 20 minutes in the afternoon and just sit and read some good books for my mind and just be calm and still, those fill the bucket up. And we have Christ-like examples for doing that. So yes, making yourself a priority is essential in order to serve other people.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Glover, where would you send people if they, obviously, I got my copy off of Amazon, so it's available there. But if people want to learn more about the nice guy syndrome and your work, where would you send them?
Well, I buy my copies of the book on Amazon as well. Just go to drglover.com. It's drglover.com. If you just want to Google No More Mr. Nice Guy or Google Robert Glover, I have the top spots on both pages there. So drglover.com or just Google me.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Glover. Well, let's definitely keep in touch. And I appreciate all of that I've learned from you and recognizing how the Mr. Nice Guy I am a little bit too much at times.
Okay, Kurt, thank you for the invitation. And I hope this was helpful, not only for you, but for your listeners as well.
That concludes my interview with Dr. Robert Glover. I hope you enjoyed it. Seriously, go out and check out his book. This is one to put on your bookshelves to give to leaders because, quite frankly, folks, we got a lot of nice guys out there in the church that, and many of them are leaders. And that's okay. You know, I'm not trying to point out too many flaws, but part of this is part of leading LDS is to have some introspective, right? And to really consider how we approach things and some of our traits that seem really good, maybe are those good traits actually hurting our leadership and making us less effective and bringing too much stress and burden on us or leading us down paths we never, ever intended to go? And also, how is our leadership impacting others? Are we encouraging our young men to be Mr. Nice Guys later on in life? And again, there's no perfect answer to this. Maybe there's a deeper research somewhere else or more that we can learn. But I think the point is that we have to at least start talking about it. This would be a great discussion to have with your ward council, a great discussion to have with your young men's president, your young women's president, and ask yourself, how are we indirectly influencing the youth in our ward? And is there any problem there? Are we helping them? Are we hurting them? How can we better bring more meaning to the sacred experience in the church? And so that they develop with strong, stable testimonies and perspectives of the gospel, of prophets, of commandments, so that they can not just keep the commandments, but be sanctified by the commandments because they understand why they're keeping them. So definitely check out Dr. Glover's work, and it's definitely a good read. And go follow him at his website, drglover.com. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the 3 most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.